right, so I'm good. All right, so this is bio 241, and it's Tuesday, November 9th. And let's look at the schedule. We have two lectures before the next test, which is scheduled a week from today. It's on the 16th. Yeah, so it's the 16th. That's when the next test is. And that's going to be exam 4. And that's going to cover muscle physiology, blood cardiovascular physiology. So muscle is 12, blood and cardiovascular is 13, and cardiovascular by itself is 14. So I got to get through chapter 14 to get that on the test, because I don't want to put all those chapters on your last test, which is on December 14th, and that's probably only a couple of weeks away as well. Okay, and you only have a couple labs left. All right, so does anybody have any questions on this Wiggers diagram? What you should know, yeah? Yeah, I believe that's correct. Okay, but I'll have to check the schedule of classes. I'll double check a couple more times, because it's hard to read that table sometimes, but that's when it's scheduled for. Okay, and that's going to be in the morning. It's going to start an hour earlier. It's going to be at 10:30 instead of at 11:30, which is the normal class period. And you get 2 hours for the test. It's just a regular test. I'm sorry? Oh, when is the final? The final. Okay, so the final starts at 10:30 and it goes to 12:30. And it's just it's a regular test. I won't make it extra long, even though you get 2 hours to do it. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around, and I think maybe the hardest thing to appreciate on this Wiggers diagram is, why does fluid move from one part of the body to another? It's due to pressure, right? And just like for diffusion relies on a concentration gradient, material moving from high concentration to low. Fluid will move in your body from pressure, the gradient, and the gradient is what? High to low. So fluid will move from high to low. And a fluid can be anything like blood, which is a liquid, or it could be a gas, right? And we're going to look at the respiratory chapter, and we're going to understand why gas like atmosphere moves in and out of your lungs. And that's going to be due to a pressure gradient, and it will always move from high to low. Okay, and so when the blood tries to move backward or retrograde from one chamber to another, then there are valves that prevent that from happening, and that's when those valves close. Okay, producing these heart sounds that we talked about, two important heart sounds. The first one is when the AV valves close, and what the heck is an AV valve? Atrioventricular valve, right? Like the tricuspid, bicuspid valves. And the second heart is when the semilunar valves close. Right, and those are at the root of the pulmonary trunk and the aorta. All right, so when does the AV valve close? That could be a good question on the test, but this one right here, this figure might be on the test as well that you have to label, and this figure will tell you what the correct answer is. All right, that's one nice thing about having figures on tests, because it helps you answer a lot of questions. So when does an AV valve close? During systole or during diastole? Systole, when the ventricles start to contract, right? That's when an AV valve closes, so blood doesn't go back up into the atria. And when does the second heart sound produce? Okay, when the semilunar valves close, that's when the pressure decreases in the ventricle. Pressure decreases in the ventricle when it's relaxing. And there's still high pressure in a great artery, like the pulmonary or aorta. When it tries to go back into the ventricle, that's when the semilunar valves close. So we got first heart sound during systole, second heart sound during diastole. Okay, heart murmurs. These are really important to diagnose, because if there is valve damage, that will eventually kill the heart. That would be like you walking up a sand dunes for the rest of your life, or for all day long. I doubt if any of us could walk up a sand dunes for 24 hours, much less for the rest of our life. Right, that's eventually going to kill the heart. When a valve is damaged or it has an irregular shape, it will produce sounds. And we call these murmurs. There are other kinds of murmurs that we can hear in the heart, but one class will be due to ineffective valves or insufficient valves. And valves can be damaged for a number of reasons. Maybe you're just born with a damaged valve. It didn't get built properly during development. That just happens. And that's maybe a trait that you might pass on to your children, and it might not be. Maybe it was just a random occurrence that happened. All right. Infections can also damage valves. And rheumatic fever is a pretty good example of a disease that can damage valves, and it's due because antibodies that your own immune system produces will cross-react with the heart tissue. And so that's always an unfortunate circumstance when that happens. And in particular, Streptococcus mutans and lactobacilli are the kinds of bacteria that produce dental caries. Right, so you could think of cavities in your mouth as actually be a result of an infection. It's due to this bacteria. And what can you do to prevent bacterial infections? Have you ever gotten a vaccine? Yeah, so it is possible to produce vaccines against these bacteria in people. Right, but unfortunately, it has been found that when that vaccine works on people, then the person builds antibodies against their own heart tissue. So it is true that we can prevent dental caries or cavities by vaccination, but unfortunately, what else then happens? Well, the heart gets destroyed, and then the patient, nice thing, won't ever have any dental cavities, but then they need a heart transplant, all right? Or they die. Neither case is really good, so no one has been able to figure out how to produce a vaccine to prevent dental decay without destroying somebody's heart. So the tissues can cross-react. Other ways that valves might be not working properly is by stenosis. A stenosis or stenotic valve doesn't open properly. So there are two ways a valve can misbehave. Maybe it doesn't close, and it allows blood to leak back, or maybe it doesn't open properly, either one of those. So stenosis is when it doesn't open properly, maybe because it's become thickened, or maybe there are calcium deposits or cholesterol deposits on that valve, and it will also make kind of a squeaking sound. Okay, so valves, anytime valves don't work, we say they are insufficient or incompetent. When they don't, and one reason might be because they don't close properly. And this could be due maybe to damage of a papillary muscle or damage due to the leaflets of the valve themselves. And whenever there is an incompetent valve, it's got to be repaired, or if it can't be repaired, it has to be replaced. All right, and maybe your book talks about different kinds of procedures, and if it's replaced, it could be replaced with a cadaver, a human valve, a cadaver valve. All right, or maybe it could be replaced with a pig valve. Pig hearts are very similar to human hearts. Or maybe it could be replaced with a mechanical valve. Each has their own drawbacks and their own positives. Like, for instance, if you get a human valve that fits most properly with your heart, but what are some things you have to be concerned with when you get transplanted tissue? Okay, yeah, it's got to be typed properly, right, cross-matched, but you could also pick up an infection. And some infections you don't want to have, like hepatitis, right? That's probably just as deadly under some certain circumstances as an AIDS virus, which you could also pick up. All right, mechanical valves, you don't have to worry about infection, but mechanical valves are a little rough on blood. They have a tendency to generate blood clots. So then you have to be on anticoagulation therapy your whole life. Right, if you get a pig valve, then you have to be on immunosuppressants for the rest of your life. So these are just some of the choices you have to make. But in either case, it's much better to have a heart that is working properly and be on these pharmaceutical agents for the rest of your life rather than giving up your heart completely, right? Okay, other kinds of murmurs might be due to septal defects. So what the heck is a septum? Separate parts of your body, like your nasal cavity is separated into right and left by the nasal septum, right? The ventricles are separated from each other by the interventricular septum, and the atria are separated from each other by the interatrial septa that we have right here, right? As you know, during development, as when you're a fetus, before you're born, right, there is a hole, and this is a normal occurrence, there is a hole between the right atrium and the left atrium right here, which bypasses the pulmonary circulation because you're not using your lungs before you're born. What is the organ that's doing the job of the lungs for the fetus? Yeah, it's the placenta, right? So the fetus is getting oxygen from the placenta. So to relieve the energy requirements of pumping blood through the lungs, there is the foramen. What's a foramen in anatomy? That's a hole, foramen ovale. So blood can go directly from the right atrium into the left over here, bypassing the pulmonary circulation. All right, and that should close when you're born. It might take a while, and in some people it really doesn't ever close. And if it leaves a large foramen, that eventually will kill the heart and should be repaired. So after you're born, if you have that patent foramen ovale, then that should be repaired, and that's what a PFO, right? Patent foramen ovale. So if a blood vessel is transmitting or conducting blood through the lumen of that vessel, we say it is patent. It's not occluded. All right, so when that foramen is open, it's a patent hole in the heart. Okay, it's going to make a squeaky sound. You could have a hole in the interventricular septum. And here we see blood squirting from, which way is it moving? From left into the right ventricle, right here. And that's always how it's going to work. Why is blood always going to squirt from the left to the right and not from the right to the left? Because there's always higher pressure in the left ventricle compared to the right, because the resistance of the systemic circulation is a lot higher compared to resistance of the pulmonary circulation. So the pressure in the left side of the heart is always a lot higher. Oh, I did show you a slide on that. Okay, so blood is always going to squirt into the right atrium, and it's going to decrease the function of the left ventricle and eventually will kill the left ventricle as well. So that has to be repaired for sure. Okay, so these are septal defects that have to be repaired. Oh, this is what I wanted to say. And that's because blood never squirts from the right into the left because of something that we're going to talk about in the next section, and that is how the heart contracts. Both atria contract together, and both ventricles contract together. First the atria and then the ventricle. So it's never the case that the right ventricle contracts while the left ventricle is relaxed. If that was the case, then blood would squirt from right into left. But since both ventricles contract at the same time, and always the left ventricle with more force, blood squirts into the right ventricle when that happens. Okay, so let's see why the two superior chambers contract together and followed by contraction of the two inferior chambers. All right, so remember a little histology. Myocardial cells are short. They're not like skeletal muscles, which are really long. They're also branched. Again, that is unlike skeletal muscles. And they are interconnected with gap junctions, which is one component of the intercalated disc. There are also adherence junctions in the intercalated disc that glue the myocardial cells together so that when they contract, they don't pull apart. Because if they were to pull apart, then, of course, you'd have a hole in your heart. Okay. The entire muscle that forms a chamber is called the myocardium, and it is a functional syncytium, which means that that whole chamber is going to function as a unit because of the structure in the intercalated disc, which is a gap junction, which is a sodium channel. So this allows for sodium to move from one cell to another, and when sodium moves into a cell, what happens to that particular cell? It depolarizes, right? And depolarization is basically an EPSP, and it's excitatory event, which is going to initiate excitation, contraction, coupling in all of those cells. So because action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted to all others, right, then these chambers are what we call a functional syncytium. Right? The atria and ventricle chambers are separated, don't forget, by the fibrous skeleton, and action potentials can't move through connective tissue. Action potentials are transmitted by axons, nervous tissue, right, neurons, or by muscle tissue because they have voltage-gated channels in them, but not through connective tissue or that fibrous skeleton, which lies in this plane between the atria and the ventricles. Okay, so here is something that's really important that you got to know for the test, and that is the conduction system of the heart. And in the superior part of the right atrium, very close to the orifice of the superior vena cava, there is a special region right here that contains nodal tissue. We're going to look at action potentials from nodal tissue in just a little bit. And this tissue spontaneously depolarizes, which means then that it spontaneously can do what? Excite itself, right? Because it is spontaneously depolarizing, and that's called the sinoatrial node, or sometimes we call it the pacemaker of the heart, because it has the fastest rate of depolarization of all cells, at least in the normal heart. And so it can capture the heart rate as a result. All right, so that spontaneous depolarization of this tissue, nodal tissue right here, is what we call a pacemaker potential. Okay, the other parts of the conduction system of the heart are the atrioventricular node, right, and then the atrioventricular bundle as it passes through the fibrous skeleton. So there are ways for electrical activity in the atria to go down into the ventricles through the fibrous skeleton, and it is only through this AV bundle right here, and then it splits into the right and left bundle branches, and then that excitation or action potentials is spread to the myocardial cells via these tiny, tiny little fibers, conducting fibers right here that we call Purkinje fibers. And everything that you see in yellow right here, or maybe it's a bright green, I'm not sure, these are, well, thanks, yeah, they're yellow. These are myocardial cells. They're not nervous system cells, but they're just specialized not to contract, but they're specialized to conduct action potentials or nerve impulses, which then spread throughout the heart. Okay, so if we look at an action potential from nodal cells, we see that there is really no stable resting membrane potential. Cells are either depolarizing rapidly, repolarizing rapidly, or slowly drifting up to threshold. All right, so the membrane voltage starts at about minus 60 millivolts and then slowly depolarizes because in the membranes of these specialized cells, there are HCN channels. And HCN channels allow for a little leaking of sodium. And which way is sodium going to go? Yeah, it's going to go from outside to inside. Right, so it's slowly going to depolarize these cells, and then when it reaches threshold, okay, which is about minus 40 millivolts, then there are some voltage-gated channels that open, and in particular, calcium voltage-gated channels. And what kind of ion is calcium? It's a cation. What kind of ion is sodium? It's a cation, so it's going to have the same effect. All right, but twice the magnitude as sodium diffusing inside the cell, it's going to cause a rapid depolarization, all right, and that is going to then cause neighboring regions to become excited and transmit this action potential through different parts of the heart and through the conduction system. All right, so this rapid depolarization phase, unlike in neurons, which is due to sodium voltage-gated channels, it is calcium voltage-gated channels in the heart. Okay, repolarization is still due to opening of potassium channels, which then repolarize the heart tissue. All right, and when it's repolarized, those HCN channels open up again and start to drift back up to threshold. So we see that the pacemaker produces these rhythmic action potentials periodically, depending on the slope of this pacemaker potential. If the slope is very shallow, what's going to happen to the heart rate? It's going to slow down. If the slope is really high, the heart rate is going to speed up as a result of that. Okay, so we're going to look in the next chapter, see how that happens and what regulates that. So when I look at these kinds of action potentials, I can tell that it's not a neuron. How do you know this is not a neuron? Because we don't have that hyperpolarization right here, right? And that it is a nodal cell, not a myocardial cell in the heart. We're going to see what a myocardial cell looks like, or a contractile cell, in just a second. Okay. All right, and it just so happens that the SA node has the steepest slope, so it has the fastest rhythm for generating these action potentials in the heart. Okay, and then what can you tell me about these action potentials? Where do they go in the heart? And why? There's a special little feature that myocardial cells have. These action potentials can spread through the whole myocardium because it has gap junctions, right? Right, it has gap junctions. So the heart, the whole heart contracts as a unit. Okay, there can be other pacemakers in the heart that develop when there's pathology in the heart. that start to depolarize at a faster rate than the SA node. Right, so other tissues in the heart are spontaneously active, but usually they are at a slower rate of depolarization than the SA node. So the SA node remains the active pacemaker. But if there's damage to the heart, other parts of the heart might actually take over the function of the SA node, and that's what we would call an ectopic pacemaker. Ectopic just means at a location other than the normal location. What's the normal location for the pacemaker? The SA node, that's right. Okay. Okay, so it is possible for the heart to beat with two different rhythms. For instance, if this atrioventricular bundle right here was damaged due to a heart attack in this region right here, right, the atria will be controlled by the sinoatrial node. It will contract at one rhythm, and the ventricles will be controlled by an ectopic pacemaker somewhere else down in the ventricles. And the ventricles will beat at their own particular rhythm. Usually that's not too clinically important because the job of the atria is so insignificant, it hardly loads any blood into the atria whatsoever. Okay. And would you have two heart rhythms? That's what we would call bigeminy, for instance. Okay. All right, now the other kinds of cells inside the heart besides the nodal cells are the myocardial, the contractile cells. All right, and they have a resting membrane potential of minus 90 millivolts, which is a little bit more typical. All right, and when they depolarize to threshold by action potentials from the SA node, all right, that's going to start excitation-contraction coupling. So let's look at an action potential from a myocardial cell. So this is just a plot of voltage versus time. And the time is about the same time scale that we used for action potentials in neurons and the nodal tissue. But notice that this action potential looks a lot different. Why does it look a lot different? Now, you were always taught that all action potentials are the same. All right, now we're showing you that they're a little bit different depending upon what tissue they're in and what cells are generating them. And it's really important to consider why this action potential looks a lot different. So what's the difference in this action potential from myocardial cells that actually contract? The duration of the action potential is a lot longer. Okay? So let's look and see why that is. Well, depolarization is still due to voltage-gated sodium channels producing this rapid depolarization. Okay, and then that inactivation gate closes, so depolarization stops. But now there are two voltage-gated channels that open up. There's a calcium voltage-gated channel, which is slow, and a potassium voltage-gated channel, which is even slower. All right, so which way, when these calcium channels open up, which way is calcium going to move? It's because it's high outside, it's going to move inside the cell, and when it does, it's going to maintain the depolarized state of this action potential. And you're going to see why that is so hugely important. We call this the plateau phase in a myocardial cell action potential. So here's the plateau phase. It's due to what ion?
Calcium
moving inside the cell, maintaining that depolarization. And then those gates slowly close, and repolarization is due to potassium leaving the cell. That's just the typical repolarization scheme that you're used to. Okay. Now, when you consider an action potential from a neuron, right, once it depolarizes, once it reaches threshold and depolarizes, right, and an activation gate closes. So what does that produce? What do you know about action potentials? Can they sum? Action potentials? Can they sum? And the answer is they cannot sum because of what? A absolute refractory period right here because that inactivation gate closes. So action potentials cannot summate, and action potentials in the heart cannot summate as well either. All right, so because this absolute refractory period for myocardial heart cells is so extended, that means that, and again, action potentials cannot summate. You can't produce another action potential causing a contraction. It means that the heart cannot go into tetanus. And other skeletal muscles can, right? Did you ever get a muscle cramp? Your biceps or your gastrocnemius contracts, all right? Does it relax? Well, what would happen to you if your heart went into tetanus or contracted? It's not going to be able to pump any blood. primarily because blood couldn't get into the ventricles to be pumped anyway, right? But since the heart can't pump blood, what would happen to you if your heart went into tetanus? Well, that would be the end of the story, right? Because you have 2 seconds of consciousness and then 2 minutes of life before your brain dies, right? That's a really short period of time. So because the heart has these voltage-gated calcium channels producing this plateau phase, heart muscles cannot go into a state of tetany, and that just protects people's lives all the time, okay? Because the heart just can't go into a contracture like other kinds of muscles, like skeletal muscles. All right, so that's the important reason for this plateau phase. All right, so what kind of cells inside the heart have a plateau phase? It is the myocardial cells, but think of those as the cells that actually contract. The contractile cells, there are other cells that we call what? Nodal cells. They don't have that plateau phase right here, but that's okay because these muscle cells are specialized to do what? Transmit action potentials and not contract. You don't have your whole ventricle loaded up with nodal-type cells like you do contractile cells that have this kind of action potential. Okay, so contractile cells have the plateau phase right here. Okay, so let's go back to the conducting system of the heart. The SA node is the typical pacemaker. It generates an action potential, and it flows through the atria. There are internodal pathways, right, that might spread that action potential throughout the whole atrium. And then it gets to the AV node right here. And the AV node depolarizes slowly. So it takes a long time for those action potentials to get into the ventricles. So all of the atria, both atria depolarize and start to contract before that excitation signal even makes it into the ventricle because of the delay at the AV node. Right. Once it makes its way through the fibrous skeleton, then the speed of conduction through the right and left bundle branches is very, very fast. And notice that here in the septum, I don't see any Purkinje fibers. Where do you first run into Purkinje fibers? Way down here at the apex, right? And then, lastly, in the free wall of the myocardial tissue right up over here. And these Purkinje fibers are really specialized structures that spread out an action potential throughout the whole myocardium. So because the speed of contraction down the septum is so fast, the apical regions of the ventricle start to contract first before the more basal regions. Remember, this is the base of the heart here. This is the apex down over here. And I lost the cursor. Where did it go? Here it is. All right, so this means, right, since action potentials develop first in the apical regions of the heart compared to the basal regions, what does that mean? Excitation-contraction coupling starts in the apex before the basal region right here. But how is it that the ventricles pump blood? Which way does it move? Does it move from the base down into apex to be pumped, or does it move from the apex up to the base to get pumped out? Yeah, it's got to move from the apex up to the base because that's where the orifices for the pulmonary artery and aorta are. All right, so blood should move from the apex within the ventricle up to the base to get efficiently pumped from the heart. So the conduction system does a couple of things. All right, because of the delay in the AV node, it allows for the atria to contract first, helping load some blood into the ventricles. And then because of the bundle branches, the apical regions of the ventricle start to contract next, pumping blood up toward the base and out the great vessels of the heart. So the coordination of how the heart contracts, we said it contracts as a unit, but now we're telling you what? There's a little modification to that. Both atria contract first, followed by both ventricles, and as a matter of fact, both ventricles start to contract where? Down here at the apical region first, and then the wave goes up. Okay, so that's an important little modification, and you got a couple slides here that kind of just go over those points as well. Okay, so depolarization of the myocardial cells open voltage-gated calcium channels in the sarcolemma. So myocardial cells do have the sarcoplasmic reticulum surrounding the myofibrils, just like skeletal muscle. But there are no reanodyne receptors. There are no mechanical coupling between the transverse tubules in a myocardial cell and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The depolarization and transverse tubules open voltage-gated, calcium channels that allow sodium to enter the myocardium from the outside, from the interstitial space. And as that calcium floods around the sarcoplasmic reticulum, there are special calcium release channels. All right, so when calcium starts to go up around the myofibrils and cardiac muscle, just that increased concentration of calcium opens calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, allowing more calcium to leave, which allows what? Cross bridges to form, right? So it binds to troponin, tropomyosin moves out of the way, and then cross bridge cycling can begin in the heart. All right, so those channels that are sensitive to just calcium concentration are what we call calcium-induced calcium release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then as the depolarization signal fades away, right, repolarization begins and calcium is pumped out of the cell into the interstitial space and also back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when calcium levels decrease, then troponin loses its calcium, tropomyosin gets back in the way, and the muscle starts to relax. Okay, so here is a plot of a couple things. We see this thing right here. It looks kind of gray to me. What is this gray thing?
Green.
It's green. It's a really lousy green. Okay, this is, that's the action potential of a contractile cell, right? And you recognize that right away because why? Of this plateau region right here, which is due to what kind of channel?
Calcium.
Calcium, yeah, voltage-gated calcium channel. All right, so notice that it's a very extended depolarization, and here is the contraction, right, of the heart. So this is actually showing what? An electrical event as well as a mechanical event of that particular heart cell. All right, so here is the action potential, and here is the contraction of that cell. And notice that the refractory period lasts for almost the whole length of that muscle twitch. And because of that, right, this muscle right here cannot sustain contraction. It cannot go into tetany, which is good for us, that the heart cannot go into tetany. So that's what this slide right here shows, that the refractory period prevents these muscle twitches from summating or producing tetany within the heart. Okay. All right, so here is a couple more plots of just electrical activity. We can put electrodes on somebody's skin and measure the electrical activity of the heart because there's millions and millions of heart cells that are depolarizing and repolarizing, and all of those signals will summate as they move to the surface of the skin, and we can measure it pretty easily with an electrocardiograph. And this is what all those signals look like. All right, so here is just a single action potential, what it looks like, and this is from a contractile cell of a ventricle. All right, but what did we say happens before contraction of the ventricles? What chambers contract first?
Atria.
The atria contract first, right? So this just shows a signal for contraction for the ventricles, but we know that there is something preceding that, and that is contraction of the atria due to depolarization of the SA node. Right? So the SA node, when it depolarizes, causes depolarization of the atria, and that's what we call the first wave in the ECG, electrocardiogram. Right? So what's another word for first? Yeah, prima, right, primavera, right? So that's probably why that got named the P wave right there. That's just the first wave in the electrocardiogram. And, of course, the electrocardiogram could be spelled a couple different ways. It could be spelled with a C in cardio, or a more typical classical European way, maybe German way of spelling cardio is with a K. So within hospitals, you'll see ECG in the hallways or EKG. And as a matter of fact, you could be in one hallway and you'll say, well, you go this way for an ECG, and you go to that hallway and then there's signs for EKG, go this way. Well, don't change your direction because both of these terms mean exactly the same thing, right? It's just a different historical spelling of them. Okay, so an ECG or an EKG is the summation on the surface of your skin of what? Millions of cells that are depolarizing. And that, if they're coming from the ventricles, that's going to produce this big QRS signal right here. All right. And since you have fewer cells in the atria, if all those action potentials from the atria summate, it produces what? A much smaller kind of electrical signal on the surface of the skin. So that's why the P wave is so small. There are not as many myocardial cells compared to in the ventricles that produce the QRS signal right here. Well, as you know, if there is depolarization, what happens after depolarization? Repolarization happens at this point in time, and this repolarization produces the T wave in the ECG. And you should realize, where is this depolarization taking place? What chambers? The ventricles. So the T wave is ventricular repolarization. So we see atrial depolarization with the P wave, ventricular depolarization with the QRS, and then ventricular repolarization with the T wave. And we're missing something. What are we missing? The atrial repolarization. And I think maybe we mentioned this last time. It is there. It's just hard to see because it occurs at what? The exact same time that the ventricles depolarize. And here you have this big, huge signal from the ventricle, so it's really impossible to deconvolute the signal that's buried underneath the QRS complex, which is atrial repolarization. But it happens during this time here. And I used, what, the sun and star analogy in class last time. Didn't I make that analogy? It wasn't you guys. Okay, maybe I did. Maybe I didn't. I'll go over it again really fast. Well, right now, if you go outside, is it dark outside or is the sun shining? The sun is shining, right? So it's very bright. And if you look up at the sky, do you see any stars? No, you can't see any stars. Yeah, I told you that, right? But are the stars still up there? Yeah, but they're just so dim that you can't see it with the background radiation from the sun, right? So they're still there. The light from them is still reaching your eye, but you just don't have the dynamic range to see that big, that huge difference in intensity. And the same thing happens here with the QRS complex. So don't forget, that is atrial repolarization as well. All right, so here's just a definition of what is happening during those electrical events. And, oh, let me go back. Okay, so these are electrical events on the heart. What does that mean in terms of contraction? What is this? Does this actually represent contraction? No, this just represents what? Depolarization and repolarization. And this what? Is the signal for contraction. Before the heart can actually contract, what has to happen? Well, calcium has to flood into and around all the myofibrils and the cross bridges have to form. That means tropomyosin has to get out of the way. So there's a latency period between the signal for contraction and when the myocardium actually starts to contract. And where would you see that latency period? What diagram that I showed you? Okay. It's not labeled in your book, unfortunately, but it's that Wiggers diagram that has the ECG and when the ventricles start to contract, right? So there's that latency period in there. So remember, ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. They are strictly what? What kind of events? Electrical events. And if you want to measure contraction, you have to measure force or tension, right? That's not an electrical event. All right, so what do you call a machine that acquires an ECG? Okay, that's an electrocardiograph. Okay, and the thing that you look at is a gram, electrocardiogram, the thing of the piece of paper. Which event occurs first in the heart? Mechanical, which is contraction, or electrical events? Electrical events happen first, and then there's a latency period, and then the mechanical events take place. All right, so here is a pretty nice slide that usually we go over in lab pretty well, and it just shows the sequence of events with the ECG. And what is that again? ECG is what kind of event? Is that contraction or just electrical? It's just electrical, right? So you see depolarization probably in a really nice color like yellow right here. Starts at the SA node, flows over both atria. Both atria depolarize before what happens? Before depolarization enters the ventricles because of what? The fibrous skeleton is blocking it, right? Plus the AV node depolarizes very slowly, so it acts like a delay for entry of depolarization into the ventricles. So after the atria both depolarize, then, right, that signal speeds very fast down through the bundle branches down to the apex before the Purkinje fibers spread it through the ventricular myocardium, and then it moves its way up toward the base, Okay, and then during that time, maybe you see another color up in here, which is what? Repolarization of the atria when the ventricles are depolarizing. And then the heart starts to contract, pushing blood up the great arteries, all right? And then repolarization starts in the same regions that depolarization started first, which is what? The apical regions of the ventricles. Okay, we talked about heart sounds already. Probably don't need to belabor that very much. So let's just move on to blood vessels. All right, but I think you're going to have to review a lot of this anatomy on your own, but hopefully, right, you'd never forgot any of this stuff. Like, here's a question. Material can enter or leave the blood only through what kind of blood vessel?
Capillary.
All right, what structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? There's the precapillary sphincter, right, which is a circular smooth muscle, which is regulated by local control, just the metabolic demand of that tissue. When that precapillary sphincter dilates, that allows blood to flow into the capillary. When it's constricted, then blood will flow to other parts of the body. Okay, what two mechanisms help return blood to the heart? So blood is going to move. What does blood need to move from one place to another? Pressure gradient. The bigger the pressure gradient, the faster the flow, right? The bigger the concentration gradient, the faster the rate of diffusion. You learn that, all right? But in veins, blood pressure is very low. It's maybe 2 or 3 millimeters of mercury. The pressure in the right atrium might be about 0, might be a little bit negative, maybe 1. So you only have a handful of millimeters of mercury pushing blood through veins back to the heart. That's not a very big pressure gradient. So there has to be other mechanisms that move blood back to the heart once it's in a vein. Okay. And I got a couple slides on that. You should know what that is. There are two things. There is the respiratory pump and skeletal muscle pump. Skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump. We'll look at that. Here's another thing that you got to be able to state. Name 3 types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. Well, you probably know at least one. What kind of... The heart has valves, okay, and you got to come up with 2 more places that have valves. Veins have valves, and there is something that's a lot like a vein. It has fluid at very low pressure that will want to squirt back and forth, but it should move back to the heart, and those are lymphatic vessels. So lymphatic vessels act just like veins, but they're not carrying blood. They're basically carrying just the fluid part of blood, which is plasma. All right, but if it's in a lymphatic vessel, we call it lymph. Okay, lymph is really mostly like plasma. Okay, which layer is responsible for forming valves? That is the deepest layer. That's the endothelium in a blood vessel or the endocardium of the heart, right? Okay, what's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? That's a pretty good question. Somebody thought of that one? A sphincter is circular, smooth muscle, which means that it's active. It can contract. When it contracts, what is it using up?
Energy,
like ATP. It's using cellular energy when it contracts, so then it closes off a blood vessel, and then to open up that blood vessel, it has to relax. But a valve, on the other hand, is just a passive device. It's just a couple flaps of endothelium, right, and it's driven by the pressure gradient. It's driven by how flow is trying to move across that valve. It doesn't require ATP. Right? It's just the energy for moving that valve is driven from the pressure gradient. All right, so this I'm not going to go over. Okay, arteries. What the heck is an artery?
It takes
blood away from the heart. That's right. What's a vein? Brings blood toward the heart, right? And so you should know the names of some arteries that are high in oxygen. You should know some arteries that are low in oxygen. Okay? All right, so here is a pretty nice diagram that I think you had in anatomy, your anatomy books. Here we see a nice arteriole and a venule right here. Blood is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure through this capillary network if this precapillary sphincter is dilated. All right, and exchange can take place in these capillaries right here because of the structure of a capillary. What's an important structural feature of a capillary that allows for exchange? Yeah, just a simple squamous epithelium, right, or endothelium. It doesn't have the tunica externa, tunica media, which are the layers of connective tissue and other layers of smooth muscle. right, which makes this wall right here way too thick to allow for diffusion or even allow hydrostatic pressure to push fluid out. It's only these capillaries that are allowed to do that. And it's regulated by pre-capillary sphincters right here. Okay. There are three types of capillaries that you should remember. There's continuous capillaries. These are the least leaky. They have tight junctions between the endothelial cells that allows them to leak very little material from the capillary into the intercellular spaces. Right? That's typically the kind of capillary that we have in our bodies. There is a couple places where there are fenestrated capillaries, which means that there are fenestrations, which means that little windows or little tiny holes within the endothelial cells themselves that make them more leaky. So it will allow for very small molecules to move through these small little spaces. We find them in the like the glomerulus of the kidneys within the nephron. So these are specially leaky little capillaries. And then the third kind are what we call sinusoids, right? Or discontinuous capillaries. They have large gaps between the cells and they even have large spaces. The fenestrations are very large, so these are really leaky. So they allow a lot of material to move, but not so big that red blood cells or other kinds of large things leave the circulatory system. Okay, and typically the liver is a good example of where we'd find those. Veins, let's see, what should we know about veins? Majority of blood is found in veins of the circulatory system. They're very compliant. That means with a small change in pressure, they can dilate or constrict a lot. They have very low blood pressure, about 2 millimeters of mercury, and that really is not sufficient to get blood from an extremity back up to your heart, for instance, if it's your foot or something like that. All right, so what are the things that allow for venous blood to move back toward the heart? All right, so here is a vein. Okay, you know that's a vein because it's, you could say blue, okay. But there's a better reason because you see what? You see a valve. Arteries do not contain valves. So that's a dead giveaway. Here is a vein. All right, and I see this vein that is on either side of a skeletal muscle right here. All right, and blood should be moving toward the heart all the time, and these valves prevent the retrograde flow of blood. Now what happens? And you've maybe even seen this on weightlifters, for instance. What happens to the pressure of blood in this segment between these two valves when these muscles contract? Like, for instance, when I contract, or what happens to these, a better way of asking the question is, what happens to these muscles right here when they contract? Like, look at my biceps brachii right here. What's it doing? Even though it's underneath my shirt, you can still appreciate what? The bulging of that muscle, right? Okay, so muscles bulge, they get a lot thicker when they contract. And so now we have these bulging muscles on the diagram, and it's pressurizing this chamber right here, right? So when you squeeze down on a compartment, the pressure goes up. All right, so which way is blood going to squirt? It can't go retrograde because of this distal valve, but this one opens up, so whenever a muscle contracts, that is going to force blood back up toward the heart. Okay, so that's an important feature of venous return or return of blood toward the heart. So if you're ever taking a long airplane flight, say over 3 hours, guess what you should do during that flight? You should get up and you should exercise some muscles because otherwise blood will have a tendency to pool in your extremities. And whenever blood pools, guess what it likes to do? It likes to form a solid. It likes to undergo that clotting or coagulation process, right? So for sure, if you're going to hop on a flight to Denpasar or someplace like that, which might be 16 hours, you got to get up and walk around and get the circulatory system because you could be at risk of generating blood clots in this vein right here in your leg. And where is it going to go? It's going to go to your heart via the vena cava. And as blood moves from an extremity to the vena cava, the blood vessels get bigger. So there's not much chance a blood clot will get stuck there. And the size of an atrium, the right atrium, is big. There's not much chance that the blood clot will get stuck there. And then blood will get pumped from an atria to the ventricle, the right ventricle, which is a big space. There's not much chance that the blood clot will get stuck there, but then it gets pumped into the pulmonary artery, right? And then the left and right pulmonary, the pulmonary trunk, and then the right and left pulmonary arteries. What happens to the diameter of the blood vessel between the pulmonary trunk and right and left pulmonaries? It gets smaller. And then it branches again, which gets smaller. And then it branches again. Finally, you're at the capillary level. So what organ are we in now? I forget. We're in the lungs. So now as these blood vessels get smaller and smaller and smaller, that's where that clot is going to get trapped. It's going to get trapped in the lungs, and then it's going to kill that part of the lung. We call that a pulmonary embolism. And that is definitely very fatal circumstance, unless it can be treated successfully in most cases, right, if it's caught early. So proper exercise is important to maintain the health of these blood vessels. This also has some clinical ramifications because look at these veins right here. When do these valves work properly? What do they have to do? They have to approximate each other, which means they actually have to touch each other from one side of the blood vessel to the other. So if these blood vessels start to dilate, what happens to the valves? They stop functioning because now they just kind of flop back and forth. And that happens in deep veins. We call, and those deep veins can produce thrombi. We call that deep venous thrombosis. That's a really serious medical condition. You can also see that process happening on the surface of some people's skin, especially in their legs, because that's where a lot of hydrostatic pressure is. And we would call that what? Varicose veins, right? And if that gets, that should probably be treated with sanitary hose, stockings, compression hose. And sometimes maybe it's so bad those veins actually have to be removed because they're going to be producing blood clots, right? Because the valves don't work anymore right there. Oh, guess what? That's it for this particular chapter. Oh, I lied. That's the number one. That's one. We also said respiratory pump. Okay, let's go over the respiratory pump. Why does breathing return blood back to the heart? All right, so a fluid could either be a liquid or a gas. All right, so blood returns, or blood moves from one part of the body to another because it's a fluid. How does it move? From high pressure to low pressure. Okay. All right, the air that we're breathing is a fluid. It's just not a liquid. It's a gas. So air in the room, all right, will also move according to a pressure gradient. How is it going to move? From high pressure to low pressure, and that's why you look at the weather report on the news every once in a while to see what the weather is going to be like, and they show you high pressure and low pressure systems, and which way is the wind going to blow? From high pressure to low pressure, that's just the way it goes. All right, so air is going to move in your lungs and out of your lungs. Why is that? Because of pressure differences. All right, so when air is moving in your lungs, what is the pressure inside your lungs compared to the outside world? It's got to be low. Okay, and that happens because you use respiratory muscles to expand your rib cage that decreases thoracic pressure, so air flows into your lungs. All right, but as you decrease that pressure in your thoracic cavity, what other fluid is going to move into your thoracic cavity? Not just air, but blood in other parts of your body. So every time you inhale, guess what? You have increased venous return. All right, and then how does air move out of your lungs? You pressurize your thoracic cavity, so now the pressure in your lungs is higher than atmospheric pressure, and then air flows out. But what about venous blood in your thoracic cavity? When you pressurize your thoracic cavity, does blood leave your thoracic cavity via veins? Does it get pushed out? No. Why is that? Because veins have valves to them as well. And that's the reason why lymph returns to your heart as well, because lymphatic vessels have valves, and whenever you have a bulging muscle in a part of the body, that will return lymph to the heart, and every time you inhale, that is going to like suck lymph up into your thoracic cavity like a vacuum cleaner does, right? Just like why air rushes into your lungs, because there's decreased pressure inside the thoracic cavity. So venous return and lymph return to the heart is by two mechanisms, skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump. We'll look at those pressure changes a little bit in a little bit more detail when we get into the respiratory chapter. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. So let's put it away. And let's start with 14. Okay. So here's 14, cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure. we got some important things to look in this chapter. So we're going to use a lot of principles that we are already familiar with in this chapter. All right, so the first definition we have to know is cardiac output, and this is flow. All right, it's a flow because flow is not just the velocity of blood, but it's the actual amount of blood that the heart is pumping out, which is what? A volume. A volume per time, and the time unit that we like to use, right, works really well for people is a minute. That makes it a measurable sum, a convenient sum of blood to be pumped out. So cardiac output, the amount of blood that's pumped each minute by a ventricle. And what can you tell me about the right and left ventricle? Does one contract before the other? They contract at the same time, okay? Just like both atria contract at the same time. And one of the online questions is, what about the amount of blood that the right ventricle pumps compared to the left ventricle? They both contract at the same time, but what about the amount that they pump? Over a short period of time, all right, are they equal or can they be different? They really should be equal, okay? Because if the left ventricle is pumping more blood than the right ventricle, where is blood going to start to build up and get stuck? It's going to get stuck in the lungs, right? Because the right ventricle is not pumping as much blood. So the left ventricle is actually filling up the lungs with blood. So the right and left ventricle, they're contracting together. They should pump out about the same amount of blood. Otherwise, blood is going to get stuck someplace. Okay. All right, so how do we figure out what cardiac output is? Here is a nice equation for cardiac output. It is stroke volume times heart rate. Well, you all know how to measure heart rate. What would you do to measure heart rate? You'd like palpate what? Your wrist, okay. I don't know about your wrist. You mean like your carpals? How about the radial artery? Okay, because this is like an anatomy physiology class. Radial artery, and you feel this little pressure pulse coming down through the radial artery, which corresponds to systole in the heart, right? So you would count the heart rate. And stroke volume is just the amount of blood that's pumped from a ventricle for every beat, right? And how would you measure stroke volume? A little bit more difficult, but you know how to calculate stroke volume already. What is it? It is end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume. Okay, so, and that tells you the amount of blood that's pumped out of that ventricle every time it contracts, which is the stroke volume. All right, so why does this make perfect sense? Well, if we do a little quick dimensional analysis, cardiac output, what are the dimensions for cardiac output? It is a volume. Right, volume per time, right? So, and the volume measurement we like to use is milliliter. That's convenient. And the time unit is what? Minute. All right, so it's milliliters per minute. And what's that equal to? All right, so we got stroke volume. What is stroke volume? That's a volume, right? Every time the heart beats, so that's a milliliter per beat. All right, and we're going to multiply stroke volume times what? Heart rate, and what is heart rate? It is, how would you tell somebody what your heart rate is? It is beats, yeah. It's beat per minute. All right, so in this equation, what cancels out? The beats cancels out, and you're left with what? Milliliters per minute, and is that what it should be for cardiac output? Yeah, that's all you need to actually calculate cardiac output. And then here's just a little random statistic that got put into the PowerPoint right here. Huh? Oh, you might have to calculate that. Yeah, in a test. Maybe even for a quiz or something. Okay. Yeah, because you have a graph that will show you end diastolic volume and end systolic volume, right? And then I could ask you from that graph what the stroke volume is. Right, if you look at the volume curve on a Wiggers diagram of a ventricle, you could calculate stroke volume. And you could probably also calculate what the heart rate is from the Wiggers diagram and figure out what the cardiac output is. That's why it's such an important diagram. All right, so let's talk about regulation of chronotropy. And this kind of takes us back to maybe the first lab that you have. When we try to characterize the physiology of the heart, we can think of how fast the heart is contracting. That will affect cardiac output. But if the heart is contracting very weakly, what about the amount of blood that's being pumped out of it? Not very much blood is pumped out. If it contracts strongly, a lot of blood is being pumped out. So not only are we interested in the rate of the heart, but we also are interested in the force of contraction. So there are two dimensions to understand cardiac output, and we're going to look at the first one right here, which is chronotropy, which refers to what? Heart rate. All right, so without any kind of neuronal influences, the SA node we see will spontaneously depolarize, and you should remember the names of those channels, those HCN channels, right? And then that's going to capture the heart rate. And the innervation to the heart is just autonomic. There's no somatic nerves that go to the heart. It's just under autonomic innervation. Sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influence the heart rate, right, which is a chronotropic effect by adjusting the rate of depolarization of those nodal cells in the SA node. Okay, so autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate in the normal heart. So I think I have some action potentials right here. So if you look at this action potential, what kind of cell does it look like? Does it look like a nerve cell? Okay. Does it look like a conduction cell? Does it have a plateau phase? Or does it look like nodal tissue from the heart? Nodal tissue, because I see this pacemaker potential right here. Okay. And so we can see maybe the heart rate under normal circumstances is this rhythm right here, but when it is stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system, right, that opens up more HCN channels right here, so the slope of this pacemaker potential is a lot steeper, which means that it reaches threshold a lot sooner, so this action potential is initiated a lot sooner to when somebody's under this more normal condition, right? And then so the length of this action potential is the same. All right, it's just that this slope changes, which means that it reaches threshold faster. So in the same period of time, we get what? More action potentials, right? More heartbeats compared to the control situation. All right, acetylcholine, which is the neurotransmitter for what nervous system? It's a parasympathetic nervous system transmitter in most cases, right? All right, that promotes opening of potassium channels. What does that do? Yeah, it prevents... It inhibits, right, this fast depolarization, so it decreases the slope of this pacemaker potential. So it takes longer to reach threshold, which does what? It slows the heart rate down. Okay, so again, you got to be really familiar with sodium channels and potassium channels and how different parts of the autonomic nervous system activate these two channels, two types of channels, to either speed up the heart rate or slow it down, right? And don't forget that. What's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? Antagonistic to each other, right? So those nodal cells have to make up their mind how quickly they're going to depolarize based on the influence from the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, right? So it balances out those two inputs. So that happens at the SA node, but that also happens a little bit at the AV node. Okay. Now, what is the other dimension that we have to use to think about heart? Not just the heart rate, but also the force of contraction. All right? If you're ever in a life-threatening circumstance, like you're riding your motorcycle down the 405, and then about five cars converge in your lane because they don't see you, and you know you're going to die, what happens to your heart rate? It speeds up. But that's not the only thing that happens. What else happens? Yeah, your pupils dilate, but let's just think about the heart. Okay, it starts to beat with a lot of vigor. It's like pounding outside of your chest, right, really fast, and also outside of your chest because the force of contraction is increased as well. Okay, so the way that we think about those two dimensions, the rate is what we call chronotropy, the force of contraction is what we call inotropy, right? Those two dimensions for understanding how the heart is working. So it's contractility. So if something is a positive inotropic agent, it's going to increase contractility or force of contraction. If something is a negative inotropic agent, it's going to what? Decrease contractility of the heart. All right, so the cardiac control center, this is what your book calls it. I call it the cardioregulatory center. That's probably what most people call it. Is located where? In the medulla oblongata. Right, and it coordinates the activity of the autonomic nervous system. And All right? It can stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nerve endings go to the atria, just like the parasympathetic nervous system, but it also goes to the ventricles. So as the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, we say sympathetic tone increases. That increases the heart rate because of the SA node in the atria. But because sympathetic nerves go to the ventricles, that also stimulates an increase in contractility, all right, or force of contraction. So the sympathetic nervous system has a positive inotropic effect and a positive chronotropic effect on the heart. It increases the rate because of going to the atria, and it increases force of contraction because these nerve fibers go to the ventricles as well. So here's a pretty nice table that shows what region of the heart we're talking about. All right, so SA node, AV node, atrial muscle versus ventricular muscle, and the two autonomic nervous systems. We started with parasympathetic. We saw that parasympathetic stimulation decreases the rate, right, of diastolic depolarization. It decreases the slope of depolarization, spontaneous depolarization, that decreases heart rate. It also decreases the conduction rate through the AV node. But there are no parasympathetic fibers that go to the ventricles, so it can't affect the ventricles one way or the other. It can't, like, decrease contraction. Sympathetic nerves, on the other hand, go everywhere in the heart, both to the SA and AV node, increasing the heart rate, and it goes to the muscle fibers of the atria and the ventricles, increasing force of contraction. So the sympathetic nervous system is what? A positive chronotropic agent and a positive inotropic agent, while the parasympathetic nervous system is just a negative chronotropic agent. It doesn't affect inotropy of the heart at all because the nerve fibers don't go there. All right, so next time we're going to start right here with some stroke volume. Make sure you attend class next time. Just figure out what's going to be on that test coming up a week from today. So review your end diastolic volume, end systolic volume, and we're going to figure out stroke volume, how to calculate stroke volume from a Wigger's diagram.
Did you find a Wigger's diagram online?
Yeah, it's in Blackboard. Maybe I'll log into Blackboard right away.
All
right. It's in maybe course documents or something.
Okay.
Maybe it's in course documents. And more importantly, the answer sheet is there too.
Okay.
The answer key is what I mean.